are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, October 7th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On today's program, two interviews that Sam recorded yesterday. Brand newish interviews.
Yeah, for those who maybe didn't listen to yesterday's show, Sam has two interviews for all of you in the first half.
With Lawrence Lessig. Explaining the next moves by Mayday Pack, the pack to end all packs, and Eugenia Williamson on the slow self-destruction of PBS. And then,
in
on
the
fun
better half,
better half,
fun half?
Better half. In
whatever you'd like to call it.
Today's world, better. Today's specifically show,
yes.
The better half.
It's a Matt and Mike better fun half.
Indeed.
We will be bringing you stories such as...
Chris Cuomo, he wants to let you know why that infamous Reza Aslan interview on CNN really justifies the fear of the Muslim people. Have some latest updates on the fighting going on in the Middle East.
And we will have a little clip from a good friend of ours at Fox News, Gretchen Carlson.
Oh, Gretchen.
Who basically makes the pitch for Fox News, I guess, if you were trying to sell it in an elevator to some sort of executive.
Yeah, she did it.
Yeah,
30 seconds, she did Fox.
That's what we're going to be doing today. What would you call, I mean, I guess we could discuss this in the fun half. But if, like, I'll pose the question now, and
yes.
We can think about it.
Yeah.
If Andrew Cuomo is Cuomo the Lesser, then what is his brother Chris? Let's ponder on that while we
lesser to the negative power. I don't know.
We'll discuss that. The fun half.
All right. We will see you back in the fun half. Stay tuned. First up, Lawrence Lessig, then Eugenia Williamson. We'll be back in a moment.
We are back on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Professor Lawrence Lessig of the May Day PAC. And, Professor, I know we have some important news in terms of a candidate that the May Day PAC is now going to be supporting. But before we get there, for those people who aren't familiar with the May Day PAC, tell us what the May Day PAC is.
So the May Day PAC was launched this year
Mayday as in the distress signal referring to the distress our democracy is in, for the purpose of electing a Congress committed to fundamental reform in the way campaigns are funded by 2016. So in 2014, our objective is to run in a 7 to 8 races to demonstrate that this issue is salient enough to voters to make it feasible to run a much bigger campaign in 2016 to get a Congress that would actually pass fundamental reform.
And so in many respects, this is sort of this is your trial run, right? The proof of product, if you will.
Exactly right. I mean, most political analysts think people don't care about issues of process. They only care about substance. Of course, if you look at Hong Kong, you'd say that was a pretty impressive showing about care about process. But what we want to show is that here in America, in voting in campaigns where this has been made an issue, voters will vote for the candidate who makes this an issue in a convincing way and kick out people who don't.
And when you announced Mayday PAC, you made it quite clear this was going to be a bipartisan effort. So the candidates you have supported at this point, what becomes the litmus test or the determination? How do you determine what candidates the Mayday PAC is going to support?
Well, you have to be someone who has signaled your support for fundamental reform in the way campaigns are funded. So it's not enough to say that you want to reverse Citizens United. You've got to say that you're interested in, for example, vouchers to support small dollar funding. That's what the Republican candidate in New Hampshire supported, Jim Rubens, or the Government by the People Act, which is a matching grant proposal that that Congressman Sarbanes from Maryland has proposed. One of those types of changes that would radically change the way campaigns are funded. So that's a necessary condition. It's obviously not sufficient, especially in this round, because we're only doing a limited number of races. But it's also valuable in the calculation we've made that you're running against somebody who's kind of on the opposite spectrum, either, you know, somebody who's been invested in deeply in the lobbying system or has taken an extraordinary amount of money from special interests and voted consistent with those interests, not necessarily with your voters. Those things mix it together, so it's going to make it plausible for us to make the campaign, make the issue in the campaign, the way money is affecting results and actually get voters to vote on the basis of that.
And when you're doing your calculation, too, I imagine there are also other sort of more, I guess, practical considerations, right? The implications of Mayday PAC dollars, the perspective that perhaps the national party leaders are taking on the races, those type of other factors.
Absolutely. I mean, because what we want to do is at the end of this cycle change the way people think about this issue in Washington. I mean, change the way they think about it so that more will be interested in being on the right side of this issue. Change it in the sense that we make it plausible to make the argument that we can actually win a substantial number of seats in 2016 that make it possible to pass this kind of reform. But basically leverage the success in moving the dial on this issue in this range of races to making possible the change we ultimately want to see.
And the last we spoke, I think it was in early June, and you were attempting to hit a number, you know, with small donations across the country with, I guess, apparently a pledge for matching grants. Just tell us about how that that fundraising went.
Yeah, so we set up a 4-step fundraising process for this pilot campaign. The first we said we'd raise $1 million in 30 days. We did that in 13 days. Then I said I'd get that matched. Seven superstars stepped up to match it. Then when we spoke, we were in the middle of the second campaign, which was to raise $5 million in 30 days, which on July 4th at 9 o'clock East Coast time, we crossed that line. A big chunk of the reason for that was George Takei, Sulu on Star Trek, had tweeted, and that tweet, that single tweet to his list, was probably worth $750,000 to our campaign. And then the last stage of this, the one that's proven the most difficult, has been to then turn to, you know, some of the largest funders out there and say to them, you say you don't like the system, well, let's step up and support some of the reform that would change the way the system's functioning. And that, so far we've been about successful about halfway to the mark that we wanted to be on that, and you know, we're adjusting our campaign to make sure we can run successful campaigns in light of that.
What is the I want to speak to that before we get into the candidates that you've supported, and to sort of to get a I guess a report card on it, and before we talk about this latest support that Mayday PAC is offering. But what has been the greatest challenges in that regard in terms of getting the matching funds, and how that implicates the long-term 2016 plan?
Well, look, there are a lot of people out there who are the big funders of political campaigns who love the role they play. We don't have anything to say to those people. Then there's a bunch of people out there who, you know, are big players in funding campaigns. People like, you know, Tom Steyer, who's spending upwards to $100 million to get candidates elected who support climate change legislation, who also would say that they hate the current system the way it is right now. Same thing with Jeffrey Katzenberg, who, you know, is the biggest funder of Democratic candidates. You asked him what he thought about the system where people like Jeffrey Katzenberg can spend the amount of money he spends. He would say he hates it. It's a terrible system. It's the destruction of the democracy. So that class of large contributors, large players, we're trying to talk to, and we're trying to say to them, look, you don't like the system. You think the system is an embarrassment for our democracy. So you need to spend some of the money you're giving to the end of reforming the system. And I've said they should be tithing 10% of what they're giving. They ought to be at least giving to the cause of reform. And everybody I've spoken to supports the idea. And, you know, what they're doing is calculating the probability of the chances of us succeeding. So what we expect is if we are able to be successful in a significant way in 2014, then when we sit down with, you know, with people who are in that class and say to them, look, here's the model, here's the data, here's the way in which we could get to victory, many of them would say, fine, I want to be on the list of the, you know, 50 Americans who saved America. And that's the way I think that we can get the biggest amount of money we're going to need to make it possible to succeed in this.
And so, I mean, just from the perspective of those who have been critical, you know, one of the problems is that sort of this paradox, right, that you need to get 50 billionaires, or I guess 100 millionaires. I guess you won't. Nobody's going to be kept out of the club if they can show up with that kind of money. But I mean, give me your thoughts on, and I imagine there's a healthy dose of ambivalence, or maybe there's not, in terms of sort of that dynamic, the idea that you're going to have 50 people, and if half a dozen of those people say, you know, well, we have one little tweak that we want to make here, and $84 million rests on it, what do you do in that situation?
Yeah, so first, you know, our campaign, our strategy has never been just 50 million. And in fact, 50 billionaires. In fact, what we did this cycle was to buttress the balance between, you know, small dollar funding and large dollar funding so that nobody is in a position to claim ownership. And number two, you know, we're not like some general political action committee that could take one position or another on 30 different policy questions. You know, we've got one policy question we're focused on. And so it's going to be pretty obvious if we're being bent because of our funders. So if all of a sudden we come out, you know, talking about immigration, or we come out talking about the special way options ought to be taxed, it'll be pretty clear that we've been bent by our funders and not committed to our mission. But the third thing is, look, every single equality movement in the history of equality movements in the United States has had both people who would be benefited by that equality and people who would lose something by that equality standing together calling for the equality. So, you know, you could have said there was something ironic in men, after they were pushed by women, actually pushing through candidates who were going to change the way votes were handed out in the United States so that in 1920 women would get the right to vote. You could say there's something deeply ironic about men doing that, using an unjust system to give women the right to vote. But my view would have been they should use whatever means they can to create a more perfect system of equality here. Same thing with the civil rights movement. You know, the civil rights movement was obviously driven passionately by African Americans who were encouraged by the Supreme Court's stand on separate but equal being overturned to rise up and demand equality. But there were also whites who stood with them and said, yes, we want a system where our privilege in the system has been reduced so that equality as an ideal could be achieved. And that's got to happen here, too. It's not going to be enough for people who feel that the current system is oppressing them to stand up and say, we want our power back. That's a necessary part, but not enough. What we're going to have is a recognition on both sides that this system, this current system, is deeply corrupting the basic value of a democracy. And that's exactly, I think, you know, what's churned the incredible activism in Hong Kong, a very similar point. And that's exactly what I think has got to happen here.
And I don't want to belabor this point because John Kenneth Galbraith had a quote that politics is not the art of the possible. It consists in choosing between the disastrous and the unpalatable. And I pretty much subscribe to that notion to a certain degree. But how does that kind of concentration of money, how can you prevent it also from influencing how you choose candidates, right? Because, I mean, in this instance, it's obviously the money's not as concentrated in this round, and you had a more narrow field of people that you could fund. But when it comes to candidate A versus B, and there's a certain amount of money in there, how do you prevent that from happening?
Well, look, we're looking for candidates in 2016 who are committed to co-sponsoring fundamental reform. And we want to get to the magic number, 218 in the House and 60 in the Senate, at the cheapest cost possible. So that's the master of this decision. Like, what's the way to do it in the most efficient way possible? And so when we're looking between two candidates, if we could run a race in a safe Republican seat in a cheap state somewhere in the Midwest or West versus a fight in New York, I mean, well, New York, they'll be on our side anyway, but a fight in an expensive state, obviously we'll go for the more efficient way to deploy our resources to get the objectives that we have. And that objective is absolutely clear from the beginning. It's about getting a majority who will support fundamental reform, and obviously part of this will also have to include a president who will sign it.
And I think that dynamic is very important in terms of efficiency for the dollar in the announcement you made today. But let's, before we turn to that, tell us what candidates you have, Mayday PAC has supported thus far and how they have done, and curious as to what lessons you've learned from these races.
Well, we've announced in five races so far. Two of them were primary races. One was a Democratic primary in Arizona, Arizona 7, and Ruben Gallego was a candidate that we supported, and he won pretty decisively in that race. And our post-election polling shows that a significant proportion, about a quarter of the votes, moved on the basis of the issue that we had identified and pushed into the district. So that was a incredibly successful intervention at a relatively cheap price. At the other end of the spectrum, we were in New Hampshire in the Republican Senate primary supporting Jim Rubens over Scott Brown. Jim Rubens was the only Republican running for Senate in the nation who expressly endorsed the idea of changing the way campaigns are funded. We got into that race with Rubens at 9 points 3 weeks before the election. Obviously we couldn't get into the race and say, look, we're in here, but nobody thinks we can win. Nobody thought we could win going into that race because you're not going to move 50 points in the context of a 3-week campaign. But what was important to us in that was to move as we could and to measure the extent to which Republicans in that district were responsive to this message. And what we found was 37% of Republicans marked this as the number one issue that they were concerned about, this corrupting influence of money in politics. And of those people, Jim Rubens beat Scott Brown by 18 points. So this is a demonstration of salience to Republicans as well as to Democrats. Now, the other three races that we're in are all general election races. We're supporting Walter Jones, a Republican in North Carolina, who is the only Republican in Congress today to actually co-sponsor public funding legislation. We're supporting Carol Shea Porter in New Hampshire, who's been a strong supporter of reform, obviously an incumbent, somebody who we're very eager to help make sure she goes back to Washington. And the third is Stacey Apple in Iowa, Iowa 3, who's running in an open seat, but running against more traditional Washington-funded lobbyist candidates, who, again, we think we've seen in the district a strong level of support for this issue. So the remaining question is the races that we're going to get into, which I hope we can make a big announcement about the next one we wanted to announce today.
Yes, well, let's do that. I mean, this is a race, actually, that we were talking about on this program last week. And in some respects, this may be the highest profile one because it involves the Senate. Why don't you do the honors?
Right. So we are going to be in the Republican – I mean, we're going to be in the South Dakota Senate race supporting Rick Weiland, who's the Democrat. It's a three-way race right now. The independent candidate in the race, Larry Pressler, has been quite famous for his activism around the issue of reform. So in some sense, you've got Weiland and Pressler both supporting the idea of reform against Mike Rounds, who was the former governor and has been embroiled now in a pretty serious corruption or influence scandal involving these EB-5 visas program, which we think is just making more salient for voters in South Dakota the role of money in politics and the need to stand up and do something about it. Now, this is a seat nobody thinks the Democrat is going to get. But we know from the research we've done that this is definitely winnable for Weiland. And so we're going to do everything we can in coordination with as many other groups as we can to move the dial on this race and make Weiland the next senator from South Dakota.
And so my understanding is, I mean, how much will Mayday PAC be putting into this race in terms of funding?
Well, right now we've committed at least $1 million with the group of reformers that we've put together. And David Donnelly at Every Voice has been doing an extraordinary job coordinating to pull this group together. We expect to spend at least $2 million. And depending on how quickly we can convince others that this is indeed in play, we are expecting that number will be even higher. So the idea right now is to make a play in a strong enough way where, you know, we've put the money down for the television ads so that people begin to rethink their calculus of what's actually possible here, because obviously a lot of people focused on the constant news that you're getting just this weekend from the New York Times, for example, saying that the Senate is going to the Republicans. Well, if this seat goes the other way, that's not going to happen. And so we are very, very eager to rally people to build the support necessary to make sure it doesn't happen.
And indeed, the polls that we've seen that have come out in the past week show Weiland down, but they vary, of course. And this latest aspect of the scandal where Mike Rounds had basically lied to the public as to whether or not he had been subpoenaed in this case or had been involved in whether or not, I should say, he was served with papers in this lawsuit broke just the other day. So Weiland was within 10 points, depending on which poll you looked at. But there was there seems to be a huge point percentage of unsure voters at this point. So how do you, when you go into a race like this and you put $1 million in and you get, you're getting a combined maybe $2 million when you include Every Voice Action, the CWA, Progressive Change Campaign Committee, Democracy for America, and presumably if the needle starts to move, there may be more money that comes in. What is it at that point do you rely on to see how much of the of money in politics resonates?
Well, of course, our whole campaign depends on demonstrating to skeptics that this issue moved the dial. Right now, we're focused on winning. But after the election, as we did in Arizona and as we did in New Hampshire, we'll do extensive research to demonstrate the extent to which people were voting on the basis of this issue. And what's interesting about South Dakota is what we're seeing is South Dakota voters, I think maybe like voters across the country, are so tired of the purely negative ads. What they really are responding to, according to our research, is comparative ads that make clear, you know, what's powerful about Rick Wylens, who's running a campaign focused on take it back from special interests who have captured our government, while contrasting the really striking way in which money is a central part of the Mike Brown story. And when you put those two together, we are seeing in our research a significant movement. And I think that over the next month, that's going to be incredibly powerful in getting people in South Dakota to rethink this race.
Getting to that point of efficiency, when you talk about putting $1 million, $2 million into the race at this point, in a state like South Dakota, what are the implications of that relative? I mean, how much money is being spent in this race, including that money? In other words, this is a big bang for the buck type of race.
Yeah, it's big bang for the buck. According to the latest cash on hand, the second quarter of the year, Mike Rounds has about $758,000 on hand. You know, I think what's happening right now is that Rounds and obviously the Republicans are going to have to scramble to put more resources into the race to match, you know, the resources that we're going to put in and hopefully the resources that we inspire others to put in. The same dynamic obviously is happening in Kansas with the Orman versus Roberts race. And the question is whether, you know, they can rally the resources to match the resources that we've put in. I think the really important thing for us, you know, there are a lot of Democrats who are in this because they want the Democrats to control the Senate. The really important thing for us is that we're able to convince people in this part of the country, traditionally conservative, voters, that this issue is incredibly salient, incredibly important, and that they need to start voting on the basis of it if we're ever going to get away from this kind of democracy where, or quote-unquote democracy, where such a tiny, tiny fraction, you know, have such enormous impact. And I think that winning a couple of these types of races, especially in the heartland of America, is really going to send a shockwave through the Beltway about just how salient this issue can be going forward.
Is this the will there be other candidates after this one that you will that the Mayday PAC will announce that they're supporting, or is it do we know the slate now?
Nope, there are more coming, even more interesting perhaps, but we'll have to wait till those things get announced.
Well, that's almost us breaking news.
Yeah.
that they will be more, perhaps even more interesting. Well, Professor Lawrence Lessig, it is maydaypac.org. Is that the site?
No, you want to go to mayday.us.
Mayday.us if you want to support this endeavor. Professor Lawrence Lessig, thank you so much for your time today.
Great. Thank you.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Pleasure to welcome to the program freelance journalist Eugenia Williamson, writing in this month's Harper's Magazine, on PBS self-destructing. Welcome to the program, Eugenia.
Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with the broadly the history of PBS and sort of well then we'll talk about sort of I guess the political travails over the past 20 years or so. Maybe it's been actually I guess almost since its inception. How long has PBS been around? What brought it out about?
So PBS started in the early 60s. The notion of a public television network sort of started getting kicked around back then. There was an interest, at the time, people were very critical of the commercial television stations that were in the content that they were putting out. If you'll recall, the assessment of television as a vast wasteland. PBS can almost be seen as a direct result of that. Wealthy foundations like the Ford Foundation the Carnegies were interested in putting forth something that was not a television station that wasn't didn't have commercial constraints and could appeal to man's better nature instead of sort of crass commercialism that they saw television commercial networks at the time sort of expressing in their programming.
It piggybacked on sort of a pre-existing network of affiliates. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. There was a national educational television network, but these were very loosely connected stations there was an office in New York that actually had to send their programming out via the mail, which is really sort of sad. And they were sort of pretty underfunded and pretty sad. So with a national, the technology at the time was such that suddenly, you could have more national programming disseminated more easily, and they were hoping to capitalize on that and thus pump some money into it. And the government was all on board when it started under Lyndon Johnson.
And that didn't last too long, though.
No, unfortunately, it did not. So there were these very, enthusiastic utopians trying to start a national public broadcasting network. And then almost immediately, there were setbacks. So in the Carnegie Commission in 1968 started to they sort of gathered together all of these different prominent people, and they were tasked with determining the best way to start this great undertaking. And so for a few years there, they pooled their resources and they did all this research, and they presented their report to Congress, who approved it, flying colors, everything seemed wonderful. But then almost immediately, they realized that they weren't going to get the funding that they wanted. And then almost immediately after that, Richard Nixon took office. So it was a bad scene.
And then what happened in regards to Nixon's race? And just also, before we even get to what Nixon said, I mean,
sure.
I think it's hard contextualize for us, if you can, as to, how important or unimportant PBS was in terms of our media, because I think it's hard for people to, particularly younger people now, to sort of see why PBS would be relevant at any juncture, because we live in a world now with, whatever, 1,000 stations, and then the internet outlets. I mean, so contextualize that for us.
Oh, certainly. Well, at the time, a younger person who, might not watch television at all, television was very central to the national discussion at that time, and it was the most prevalent form of mass media. In fact, a television network seemed like the ideal way to sort of communicate things to people, and that's why there was so much government and philanthropic interest in starting the network. So.
And what was the Nixon administration? What were the what did the Nixon administration? How did that react to PBS? At that point, you've got now a network set up, right, where you've got affiliates across the country.
And so Nixon was very mistrustful of television in general. There are actually a couple of really great books about how just skeptical he was. He thought of television in general as this instrument of Ivy League educated elites, and he was very, you know, decided in his opinion of television generally as, you know, an instrument of basically liberal propaganda. So when public television, which was something started under his predecessor's administration, came into being, there was, you know, he was terribly mistrustful, especially because it was something that started in New York, and he was trying to appeal to rural, you know, just generally, he was trying to appeal to rural folks with more conservative values, and so he was automatically mistrustful of that. Especially, so PBS's, Public Television's first, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's first president was a Johnson appointee, and that was another terrible strike against it. So Nixon was just fearful that another thing you have to bear in mind at the time when they started when this National Public Television Network came into being, which at that time wasn't called PBS, it wasn't until the early 70s, they were airing things that were sort of critical of contemporary politics. You know, the Vietnam War was going on, there was the civil rights movement, and, you know, the country was, you know, divided because of those things. And PBS programming tended to air all sides of it. So it was pretty contentious to Nixon.
But Nixon really wasn't able to have any dramatic effect on PBS, as far as I can tell.
His biggest sort of lasting impact on it was funding. He made it so he was trying to strike it down. I mean, he really tried his darndest. But his biggest, the biggest detriment that he sort of instilled, which is in this place to this day, is that he precluded long-range funding, long-range congressional funding, so that there couldn't be, that their budget wasn't, they couldn't make long-range plans. So there was this, they really wanted five-year funding. So that they could know what to plan, but they couldn't. So he did that. And Antonin Scalia also was instrumental in that, too. So.
In what respect?
He helped Nixon draft the funding bill.
And so ultimately, this becomes the sort of almost the seeds of its problems down the road, right? Because
yes, it's permanently pauperized.
So we have that situation, and give us the sort of the history of it following Nixon.
Okay, so you know Nixon's prevention of PBS having long range funding was pretty bad, and so the network sort of lost its, you know, almost immediately when it came under fire, it sort of stopped being as big a threat to the administration as the administration had once feared. I mean, even Johnson was scared that it might be critical about the Vietnam War, for instance. But then after that, it became less threatening to, Reagan, for instance, wasn't terribly concerned with it because it was already, you know, too marginal for that in a way. But then, meanwhile, let's say there was still, you know, if you'll recall in the, 80s and 90s during the culture wars, there were Republican, congressmen who were attempting to defund PBS because of its, liberal sympathies or its perceived liberal sympathies. And then, it wasn't until Newt Gingrich was on a chair that it really became a thing again. He was, you know, he wanted to zero out PBS's budget. And then, you know, After that, in response, PBS started airing all of these conservative programs. Hold on for one second.
So at what point did...
And
they,
also, can you hear that beeping?
Yeah,
that
that's okay.
My window?
Don't worry about that.
Okay.
At what point did this... I want to talk about when Newt Gingrich... the coming of George Bush too, where the the network became sort of self-consciously more conservative, I think, as a way of appeasing its critics. But at what point did it really start to rely on corporate funding?
That is something that happened almost from the jump, because there were, let's see, in the, I can't recall the exact year. I can look it up if you need me to. But one of the very first BBC drama to air on PBS, which was sometime in the early 70s, was sponsored by the Standard Oil Company. And so, that was to overcompensate for, or to compensate, rather, for their lack of government funds, which had, you know, been present from the start of my cat's meowing, to overcompensate for the government money that was missing, they had to rely on corporate sponsors.
Okay, so let's jump up. I mean, we know that during the Gingrich era, we saw the network turn decidedly conservative. Under George Bush, a Bush appointee was sort of actively attempting to move PBS as a sort of a conservative movement instrument.
Oh, hilariously, that was a Clinton appointee.
All right, tell us that story then.
So I guess the first thing that happens is that Gingrich decides to cut the fat and therefore cut PBS. And then... there was great trepidation at the network about that. And so Clinton had appointed this fellow named Kenneth Tomlinson, who was a former Reader's Digest editor. And he sort of, he was the president of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And he decided that the way to secure government funds was to make the network more conservative. So he made all the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's role is not to interfere with PBS programming. In fact, there's a mandate against it. but he decided that he was going to help get all of these conservative things on the air. So, you know, he introduced he gave Tucker Carlson a show. He got the editor of the Wall Street Journal to do a panel discussion, and it's really strange. So then after that, he decided he wanted to get Bill Moyers out, so he hired this dodgy fellow to find bias within PBS programming. So, and he did this report that was very shoddily done, and he used it to determine that PBS programming was very liberal. And once it was found out, Tomlinson was ousted, and then that's what happened there.
Okay, and so give us a sense. I mean, what is it that is causing PBS to self-destruct now?
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, lately, I think it's just at this point a matter of entropy almost. I think, you know, it's just the effect of long-term starving for more money. I mean, as the, you know, with every, you know, Mitt Romney recently used it as a platform to, you know, he said he was going to cut PBS funds during the presidential debates. And, you know, every time there's a threat that, you know, Congress is just going to revoke its entire budget, PBS goes into a panic. And then it's, you know, gradually this has made its programming more conservative. But also, you know, somebody I spoke to, a longtime PBS staffer, who's the president of Colorado Public Television, talked about this perpetual lack of funds as putting PBS functionaries in like a state of trained incapacity. So it's just it's a cumulative effect, I think, of all of the sort of turmoil that it's experienced over the years.
So wait, so this has been 40 years in the making. I'm not sure, like, why now then?
Oh, well, why now? Let's see. Yeah, I think it has been 40 years in the making, actually. And, you know, but it's become very, over the last few years, a few strange things have happened. Again, Romney, one of his platforms was to defund PBS, which is, sort of strange. But when that happened, there was this vast outpouring of sentiment on the part of progressives for the network. But then at the same time, almost immediately afterwards, Jane Mayer wrote in The New Yorker about how the film about Citizens United, Citizen Coke, was basically censored by PBS. And since then, it's sort of come out that it's been bowing to its corporate donors and private individuals of wealth with very clear political agendas. And this has happened sort of flagrantly.
And so, I know that David Sirota has done a couple of pieces on this issue. And so where is PBS and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting now? I mean, how are they responding to this situation?
How are they responding to this situation? As far as I know, they're not responding very much. So David Koch is on the board of WGBH, and he's a major donor to Nova, and many people are concerned about that association, and they don't say anything. they have responded a bit, but it's not been, I don't think they're too concerned about that. And then as far as other responses, any of the responses to Sirota's really excellent investigative work, they kind of get the brush off. As far as there have been allegations of censorship, particularly in regard to the Citizen Coke film, and they almost just brush that under the rug. They're not responding adequately, I don't think.
Well, it was just very recently Bill Moyers announced that he was going to be leaving the PBS in January of this year, and he is, or I should say, of 2015, and it is he is leaving PBS. Sadly, it's in worse shape than perhaps when he began. But Eugenia Williamson, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Welcome back, folks. We are going to go straight to the fun half where we have many. We're actually keeping it pretty fun. We've got some crisp promo sound on Reza Aslan. Might use that to pivot into a little bit more of a broader Islam conversation, which I think a lot of people have been kind of asking about, at least me, over social media. Also, Elizabeth Hasselbeck. She's doing some fear-mongering with an important public health official on Ebola. It doesn't really go so well with the director of the National Institutes of Allergies and Infectious Disease.
The Ebola outrage via conservative pundits does not end there.
No.
We will also bring you Rush Limbaugh. An incredible sound from Rush Limbaugh. But, really part of the course for him, right?
Sounds
and then
right.
Gretchen Carlson using Ebola and about 50 other right-wing talking points makes the elevator pitch for Fox News.
Basically. If you want to join us, which we would love for you to do, plenty of you are already IMing. The IMs are open. But if you want to call us at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, that is the line. We will see you.
Become a member.
Do the pitch. All right, let's do a fast pitch.
Got to become a member, everybody.
We should have done that up top.
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
Become a member at majority.fm. You could just go to jointhemajorityreport.com actually to go straight to the join page. You could also support this show by buying all your junk through our Amazon link, majorityreportkickback.com. You see no difference. You get your stuff for the same price you would get on the regular Amazon homepage. But Amazon's forced to give us a little kickback from Amazon's cut. Also, you can support the show by going to donate your account and donating your Facebook and or Twitter account to share one link by us per day. If you did so before for Facebook, please go back and check if you're still doing it, because it seems like Facebook changed permissions and you have to resubscribe to the Donate Your Account, because we lost a lot of Facebook people on Donate Your Account. So please go do that. Get your friends and your followers talking. Also, you can go to justcoffee.coop and get fair trade coffee and chocolates for low, low prices using coupon code MAJORITY. That takes off 10% off your entire order, and you support a great company that's fair trade. That's a win, 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 win. And what else? I feel like I'm forgetting something. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SamCedar. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/MajorityReport. Follow us on Twitter, @MajorityFM. Sam, Matt and Mike, Wednesday tomorrow. And then Sam will be live from Las Vegas on Thursday and Friday, bringing you all the news and fun stuff from his annual trip. So we will be going into the better half now, won't we?
Yes, we will. We'll see you there.
All right, folks.
646-257-3920 if you want to join us.
That's all, folks. See you soon.
It's always...
What was that? The Rush Limbaugh coming in a bit too soon. Wow, that scared me, actually. I'm not ready for Rush that early.
No.
We need to wait for the better half.
Hey.